Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 963, Watergate and the Assassination of President Kennedy, part 3. This is being recorded on June 20th of the year 2017. With the Russiagate PSYOP being bruited about, we are seeing many comparisons with Watergate, and not surprisingly, we are being told that Watergate was a great triumph for a free press and the process of democracy. Nothing of the sort is true. In fact, Richard Nixon, as vile as he was and as deserving of removal as he was targeted for an op, and that actually began long before his election, or in June of 1972. Trump as well has been targeted by an operation. It was Nixon's job to win re-election and then get kicked out in favor of Gerald Ford. It was Trump's job to get elected, and as long as he keeps signing legislation that the GOP Congress wants, pouring poisons into the air, into the food, into the water, completely deregulating products, ultimately leading to cancers and other degenerative diseases for vast numbers of Americans who won't have health insurance, then Trump will be allowed to stay in. But what the person they really want is Mike Pence. As I've said before, swapping out Donald Trump for Mike Pence is like swapping out Frankenstein's monster for Count Dracula. Pence is truly evil and simply lacks Trump's erraticism and vulgarity. We are going to review one of the key elements in the Watergate imbroglio, and that is the assassination of President Kennedy. We have done this in our past two shows, and what we're going to do in this program initially is to listen to my reading of Jack Ruby's interview with the Warren Commission. Now, present at this interview, in addition to Earl Warren himself, who was actually Thomas Dewey's vice presidential candidate in the 1948 presidential election as the Republican governor of California, he presided over a huge land grab in California after the Nisei, the Japanese Americans, were interned in camps following the attack on Pearl Harbor. The very sizable Japanese agricultural middle class, the Nisei middle class, had their property appropriated. Earl Warren, again, was Dewey's vice presidential candidate in 1948. He was present, also present at the interview you're going to hear, are Gerald Ford, a key Warren Commission member, a member as a young man of the America First fascist fifth column in the U.S. It was ostensibly isolationist, but financed by German intel in World War II. Also present was Leon Jaworski, a member of the board of directors of the MD Anderson Fund. He was a key Warren Commission counsel and also a member, along with Judge Robert Story, of the Texas Court of Inquiry. That was the abortive body put together by the state of Texas in order to investigate the assassination. I'll recall that it was the state of Texas that actually had legal jurisdiction in this case. The Warren Commission was a presidential fact-finding commission. It had no legal status whatsoever. It was part of the executive branch of government. It was not a member and not an element of the judicial branch of government. So Leon Jaworski, Warren Commission counsel, is another person present. Also present is Arlen Specter. He was another Warren Commission counsel. He was the crafter, the author, the prime mover behind the so-called single bullet theory, or magic bullet, as critics have aptly termed it. He also, he became eventually a Republican senator from Pennsylvania. He was Richard Nixon's first choice to be his defense counsel in the Watergate affair. So, present at this meeting, bear in mind that Nixon was in Dallas on November 22, 1963. By most accounts, left about an hour to an hour and a half before Kennedy was killed. He told the FBI a couple of months later that the only time he was in Dallas in 1963 was 2 days prior to the assassination. This, despite the fact that the New York Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, among other newspapers, carried a UPI interview with Richard Nixon in Dallas, Texas, on November 21, 1963, in their November 22, 1963 morning editions. Nixon did not want to release the Watergate tapes because he was afraid that, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing might come out. And as we have seen in our last two shows, the whole Bay of Pigs thing was a Nixon White House code word for the assassination of JFK. So as you listen to Jack Ruby's interview, or the text of Jack Ruby's interview with the Warren Commission, bear in mind that Gerald Ford, who replaced Spiro Agnew as Richard Nixon's vice president and then pardoned Nixon of all crimes he had committed, he's present. He was a key Warren Commission member. Leon Jaworski, who replaced, in addition to key Warren Commission member Gerald Ford, who replaced Spiro Agnew as vice president during the Watergate affair. Leon Jaworski, who replaced Archibald Cox, who had been Kennedy's solicitor general, was present. Jaworski was also a member of the board of directors of the M.D. Anderson Fund. And also Arlen Specter, the author of A Key Warren Commission Counsel, the author of The Magic Bullet Theory, and Richard Nixon's first choice to be his defense counsel in Watergate.
Had the Watergate scandal, as I said, been properly investigated, it would have revealed the assassination of President Kennedy. And what we're going to do is to look at one of the many elements of the Watergate scandal, in addition to Richard Nixon's presence in Dallas on 11-22-63 and his lying about it to the FBI. We're going to take a look at an aspect of President Kennedy's assassination that overlaps with Watergate, and which was one of the elements that focused my political attention in the direction that it has been in for the last 20 years or so, namely Jack Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission. Jack Ruby was interviewed by the Warren Commission in Dallas, Texas in 1964, specifically in July of 1964, and it was June 7th of 1964. And when interviewed by the Warren Commission, Jack Ruby quite obviously was attempting to indicate that there was much more to the story than the low nut hypothesis about Lee Harvey Oswald. And it's also quite obvious, as you listen to what you're about to hear, that Jack Ruby believed he was part of a conspiracy, believed he was in danger, and did not want to speak candidly with the Warren Commission members under the circumstances that obtained in the Dallas County Jail. Present at what you're about to hear were not only Earl Warren, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and the head of the Warren Commission, but also Gerald Ford, who was a member of the Warren Commission, later was named by Richard Nixon to replace Spiro Agnew as vice president, and then when Nixon resigned, Gerald Ford became president and pardoned Richard Nixon of any crimes that he had committed. Also present in what you're about to hear is Leon Jaworski. Leon Jaworski was the Watergate special prosecutor, so named by Richard Nixon to replace Archibald Cox, who was fired by Richard Nixon. Archibald Cox, by the way, had been President Kennedy's Solicitor General. Kenneth Starr was George Bush's Solicitor General. I would also point out that present at what you're about to hear was Arlen Specter, who at the time was a Warren Commission counsel. He later, and actually now, is a U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania and is chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. By the way, I would also point out that Leon Jaworski, who was named by Richard Nixon to replace Archibald Cox as Watergate special prosecutor, sat on the board of directors of the M.D. Anderson Fund, which was a CIA domestic funding conduit. Leon Jaworski was also a Warren Commission counsel who was in charge with seeing whether Lee Harvey Oswald had any intelligence connections. Jaworski found that he had none. In point of fact, Oswald had more intelligence connections than Carter had little liver pills. I would also point out that Leon Jaworski was the special counsel, co-counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry, the Texas state of Texas body that was put together by then state Texas Attorney General Wagner Carr to investigate the Kennedy assassination for the state of Texas. A couple of points in what you're about to hear that younger listeners should bear in mind. First of all, you're going to hear Jack Ruby making references to Earl Warren being in danger and to, quote, "they feel the same way about you that they do about me, Chief Justice Warren." Chief Justice Earl Warren of the Supreme Court had been a focus of intense hatred by the political right wing for the relatively liberal court decisions that the Warren Court had made. A couple of other things to bear in mind was that Jack Ruby felt that his family would be in danger because of the statements that he was making to the Warren Commission. Bear that in mind because you'll hear several references to that during the course of what you're about to hear. Also bear in mind that Jack Ruby did not trust his lawyer, Joe Tannehill, and makes several attempts to get Joe Tannehill to be removed from the room before he makes his testimony. A couple of names also to bear in mind here are Elmer Moore, a Secret Service agent, and Bill Decker, who was the Dallas County Sheriff. So again, bear in mind that what you're listening to now involves not only listening to what you're about to hear were not only Gerald Ford, the Warren Commission member who was named by Richard Nixon to be vice president to replace Spiro Agnew, an individual who then succeeded Nixon as president and pardoned Nixon of all crimes, just as George Bush, just before leaving office, pardoned many of the Iran-Contra participants of all crimes they had committed as well. Also, Leon Jaworski of the M.D. Anderson Fund, a CIA domestic funding conduit, a Warren Commission counsel who was named by Richard Nixon to be Watergate special prosecutor when he fired Archibald Cox, whom Congress had named as special prosecutor, or who had been named as a special prosecutor, I should say. Archibald Cox had been Kennedy's attorney general. Also bear in mind that, as I said, Arlen Specter, a Warren Commission counsel, who was the author of the infamous single bullet theory, or magic bullet theory, as critics have appropriately termed it, is present at what you're about to hear. And once again, bear in mind what I said about Earl Warren being a bête noire to the political right. That's something younger listeners may not be familiar with. And bear in mind again that Jack Ruby did not trust Joe Tannehill, his lawyer, and was trying to get him removed from the room. Bear in mind that Ruby was afraid for his family and afraid that his family would come to grief because of what he was going to tell the Warren Commission. And also bear in mind that Ruby wanted to get a lie detector test and sodium pentothal test, and that the Warren Commission members did not want him to have that. So again, what you're about to hear is Jack Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission on June 7th, 1964. This is from Volume 5, pages 181 through 212 of the 26 volumes of Warren Commission testimony and exhibits. And in turn, this is reprinted in a book called The Yankee and Cowboy War, subtitled Conspiracies from Dallas to Watergate. That was authored by Carl Oglesby, O-G-L-E-S-B-Y, published in hardcover by Sheed, Andrews and McNeil Incorporated, published in softcover by the Berkeley Medallion Books, and it's copyright 1976. And the ISBN number, by the way, is 0-8362-0680-0. The paperback edition, ISBN 0-8362-0688-6. War Jack Ruby testified as follows in front of the Warren Commission, and again, these excerpts from the Yankee and Cowboy War taken in turn from Volume 5, pages 181 through 212 of the Warren Commission testimony and exhibits. Warren, this is another man on my staff, Mr. Spector. Would you mind if he came in? Ruby, is there any way you can get me to Washington? Warren, I beg your pardon? Ruby, is there any way of you getting me to Washington? Warren, I don't know of any. I'll be glad to talk to your counsel about what the situation is, Mr. Ruby, when we get an opportunity to talk. And Oglesby adds in parentheses, Ruby has been intermittently begging a chance to talk to Warren alone. Bear in mind that Ruby did not trust his lawyer, Joe Tannehill, as I've indicated a couple of times. Back to the testimony. Ruby, I don't think I'll get a fair representation with my counsel, Joe Tannehill. I don't think so. I would like to request that I go to Washington and you take all the tests that I have to take. It's very important, Tannehill. Jack, will you tell him why you don't think you will get a fair representation? Ruby, because I have been over this for the longest time to get the lie detector test. Somebody's been holding it back from me. Warren, Mr. Ruby, I might say to you that the lateness of this thing is not due to your counsel. It was our own delay due to the pressures we had on us at the time. And skipping down, Ruby, gentlemen, unless you get me to Washington, you can't get a fair shake out of me. If you understand my way of talking, you have got to bring me to Washington to get the tests. Do I sound dramatic, off the beam, Warren? No, you were speaking very, very rationally. And I am really quite surprised that you can remember as much as you have remembered up to the present time. You've given it to us in great detail. Ruby, unless you get me to Washington, and I am not a crackpot, I have all my senses, I don't want to evade any crime I'm guilty of, but, Mr. Moore, have I spoken this way when we talked? Moore, yes. Ruby, unless you get me to Washington immediately, I am afraid after what Mr. Tannehill has written there, and skipping ahead, Ruby, is there any way of getting the polygraph here? Decker, that's Dallas County Sheriff Bill Decker. May I make a suggestion, Jack? Listen, you and I have had a lot of dealings. Do you want my officers removed from the room while you talk to the Warren Commission? Ruby, that wouldn't prove any truth. Decker, these people came several thousand miles to interview you. You have wanted to tell me your story, and I have refused to let you tell me. Now be a man with a bunch of men that have come a long way to give an opportunity to Ruby. I wish the president were here right now. It's a terrible ordeal, I tell you that. And Oglesby adds in parentheses, he subsides for a moment to his pat narrative, then turns back to Decker. Bill, will you do that for me that you asked a minute ago? You said you wanted to leave the room. By the way, I would point out that Decker had refused to let Ruby testify to him alone. Continuing, Decker, I will have everyone leave the room, including myself, if you want to talk about it. You name it, and out we will go, Ruby. All right, Decker. You want all of us outside? Ruby, yes. Decker, I will leave Tannehill and Moore. I am not going to have Joe leave. Joe, of course, is Joe Tannehill, Ruby's lawyer, whom he does not trust. Ruby, if you're not going to have Joe leave, Decker, Moore, his body's responsible to you. His body is responsible to you. Bill, that's Ruby. Bill, I am not accomplishing anything if they are here and Joe Tannehill is here. You asked me anybody I wanted out. Decker, Jack, this is your attorney. That is your lawyer, Ruby. He is not my lawyer. And then Oglesby adds in parentheses that Decker and law enforcement officers leave the room. Ruby adds, "Gentlemen, if you want to hear any further testimony, you will have to get me to Washington, because it has something to do with you, Chief Warren." "Do I sound sober enough to tell you this, Warren?" "Yes, go right ahead, Ruby." "I want to tell the truth, and I can't tell it here. I can't tell it here. Does that make sense to you, Warren?" "Well, let's not talk about sense. But I really can't see why you can't tell this, Commission, Ruby. But this isn't the place for me to tell what I want to tell." Moore, "The Commission is looking into the entire matter, and you are part of it. Should be." Ruby, "Chief Warren, your life is in danger in this city. Do you know that?" Warren, "No, I don't know that." "If that's the thing that you don't want to talk about, you can tell me, if you wish, when this is all over, just between you and me, Ruby." "No, I would like to talk to you in private, Warren." "You may do that when you finish your story. You may tell me that phase of it, Ruby." "I bet you haven't had a witness like me in your whole investigation, is that correct?" Warren, "There are many witnesses whose memory has not been as good as yours. I tell you that honestly, Ruby." "My reluctance to talk. You haven't had any witness in telling the story and finding so many problems, Warren." "You have a greater problem than any witness we've had, Ruby." "I have a lot of reasons for having those problems, Warren." "I know that. And we want to respect your rights, whatever they may be. And I only want to hear what you are willing to tell us, because I realize that you still have a great problem before you, and I am not trying to press you, Ruby." "When are you going back to Washington, Warren?" "I'm going back shortly after we finish this hearing. I'm going to have some lunch, Ruby." "Can I make a statement, Warren?" "Yes, Ruby." "If you request me to go back to Washington with you right now, that couldn't be done, could it, Warren?" "No, it could not be done. It could not be done." "There are a good many things involved in that, Mr. Ruby." "Ruby, what are they?" "Warren, well, the public attention that it would attract, and the people who would be around. We have no place for you to be safe when we take you out, and we're not law enforcement officers, and it isn't our responsibility to go into anything of that kind. And certainly it couldn't be done on a moment's notice this way. Ruby, gentlemen, my life is in danger here. Not with my guilty plea of execution," Oglesby adds, i.e. not because of killing Oswald. "Do I sound sober enough to you as I say this, Warren?" "You do. You sound entirely sober, Ruby." "From the moment I started my testimony, have I sounded as though, with the exception of becoming emotional, haven't I sounded as though I make sense what I was talking about, Warren?" "You have indeed. I understand everything you have said. If I haven't, it's my fault, Ruby." "Then I follow this up. I may not live tomorrow to give any further testimony. The reason why I add this to this, since you assure me that I've been speaking sense by then, I might be speaking sense by following what I've said, and the only thing I want to get out to the public, and I can't say it here, is with authenticity, with sincerity of the truth of everything, and why my act was committed. But it can't be said here. It can be said. It's got to be said amongst people of the highest authority that would give me the benefit of the doubt, and following that, immediately give me the lie detector test after I do make the statement. Chairman Warren, if you felt that your life was in danger at the moment, how would you feel? Wouldn't you be reluctant to go on speaking, even though you request me to do so? Warren, I think I might have some reluctance if I was in your position. Yes, I think I would. I think I would figure it out very carefully as to whether it would endanger me or not. If you think that anything that I am doing or anything that I am asking you is endangering you in any way, shape, or form, I want you to feel absolutely free to say that the interview is over. Ruby, what happens then? I didn't accomplish anything. Warren, no, nothing's been accomplished. Ruby, well, then you won't follow up with anything further? Warren, there wouldn't be anything to follow up if you hadn't completed your statement. Ruby, you said you have the power to do what you want to do. Is that correct? Warren, exactly. Ruby, without any limitations? Warren, within the purview of the executive order which established the commission. Ruby, but you don't have a right to take a prisoner back with you when you want to? Warren, no. We have the power to subpoena witnesses to Washington if we want to do it. But we've taken the testimony of 200 or 300 people, I would imagine, here in Dallas, without going to Washington. Ruby, yes, but those people aren't Jack Ruby. Warren, no, they weren't. Ruby, they weren't. Warren, now I want you to feel that we are not here to take any advantage of you, because I know that you were in a delicate position. And unless you had indicated not only through your lawyers, but also through your sister, who wrote a letter addressed either to me or to Mr. Rankin saying that you wanted to testify before the commission, unless she had told us that, I wouldn't have bothered you. Ruby, the thing is that with your power that you have, Chief Justice Warren, and all these gentlemen, too much time has gone by for me to give you any benefit of what I may say now. And still later, the Rankin here, by the way, is J. Lee Rankin of Warren Commission Counsel. Rankin, it isn't entirely clear how you feel that your family and you yourself are threatened by your killing. How you feel that your family and you yourself are threatened by your telling what you have to the commission? How do you come to the conclusion that they might be killed? Will you tell us a little bit more about that if you can, Ruby? Well, assuming that, as I stated before, some persons are accusing me, falsely, of being part of the plot, naturally, in all the time from over 6 months ago, my family has been so interested in helping me. Rankin, by that you mean a party to the plot of Oswald? Ruby, that I was a party to a plot to silence Oswald. And skipping down, Warren, Mr. Ruby, I think you are entitled to a statement to this effect, because you have been frank with us and have told us your story. I think I can say to you that there has been no witness before this commission out of the hundreds we have questioned who has claimed to have any personal knowledge that you were a party to any conspiracy to kill our president. Ruby, yes, but you don't know this area here. Warren, well, I will make this additional statement to you, that if any witness should testify before the commission that you were, to their knowledge, a party to any conspiracy to assassinate the president, I assure you that we will give you the opportunity to deny it and to take any tests that you may desire to so disprove it. Skipping down, Ruby, and I wish that our beloved president, Lyndon Johnson, would have delved deeper into the situation, hear me, not to accept just circumstantial facts about my guilt or innocence, and would have questioned to find out the truth about me before he relinquished certain powers to these certain people. Consequently, a whole new form of government is going to take over our country, and I know I won't live to see you another time. Do I sound sort of screwy in telling you these things, Warren? No, I think that is what you believe, or you wouldn't tell it under oath. Ruby, but it is a very serious situation. I guess it's too late to stop it, isn't it? And skipping down, next you'll hear from Gerald Ford, a Warren Commission member, who, as I've said a couple of times, was already, was named by Richard Nixon to replace Spiro Agnew as vice president. Later he succeeded Nixon as president and pardoned Nixon of all crimes that he may have committed. Ford, are there any questions that ought to be asked to help clarify the situation that you described? Ruby, there is only one thing. If you don't take me to Washington tonight to give me a chance to prove to the president that I am not guilty, then you will see the most tragic thing that will ever happen. And still later, Ruby. Now maybe something can be saved. It may not be too late, whatever happens, if our president, Lyndon Johnson, knew the truth from me. But if I am eliminated, there won't be any way of knowing. Right now, when I leave your presence now, I am the only one that can bring out the truth to our president who believes in righteousness and justice. But he's been told, I am certain, that I was part of a plot to assassinate the president. I know, your hands are tied, you're helpless. Warren. Mr. Ruby, I think I can say this to you, that if he has been told any such thing, there is no indication of any kind that he believes it. Ruby, I am sorry, Chief Justice Warren. I thought I would be very effective in telling you what I have said here. But in all fairness to everyone, maybe all I want to do is beg that if they found out I was telling the truth, maybe they can succeed in what their motives are, but maybe my people won't be tortured and mutilated. And skipping down, Warren. Well, you may be sure that my president and his whole commission will do anything that is necessary to see that your people are not tortured. Ruby, no. Warren, you may be sure of that. Ruby, no. The only way you can do it is if he knows the truth, that I'm telling the truth, and why I was down in that basement Sunday morning. And maybe some sense of decency will come out, and they can still fulfill their plan, as I stated before, without my people going through torture and mutilation. Warren, the president will know everything that you have said. Everything that you have said. Ruby, but I won't be around, Chief Justice. I won't be around to verify those things that you are going to tell the president. Tannehill, who never left the room. Who do you think is going to eliminate you, Jack? Ruby. I have been used for a purpose, and there will be a certain tragic occurrence happening if you don't take my testimony and somehow vindicate me so my people don't suffer because of what I've done. Ruby. But we have taken your testimony. We have it here. It will be in permanent form for the President of the United States and for the Congress of the United States and for the courts of the United States, and for the people of the entire world. It is there. It will be recorded for all to see. That is the purpose of our coming here today. We feel that you're entitled to have your story told. Ruby, you have lost me, though. You have lost me, Chief Justice Warren. Warren, lost you? In what sense? Ruby, I won't be around for you to come and question again, Warren. Well, it is very hard for me to believe that. I am sure that everybody would want to protect you to the very limit, Ruby. All I want is a lie detector test, and you refuse to give it to me. Because as it stands now in the truth serum and any other pentothal, how do you pronounce it, whatever it is, And they will not give it to me because I want to tell the truth. And then I want to leave this world. And skipping ahead still further, Ruby. How are we going to communicate and so on? Warren. We will communicate directly with you. Ruby. You have a lost cause, Earl Warren. You don't stand a chance. They feel about you like they do about me, Chief Justice Warren. I shouldn't hurt your feelings in telling you that. That again, Jack Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission from Volume 5, pages 181 through 212 of the 26 volumes of Warren Commission testimony and exhibits. And in turn, that was reprinted from Carl Oglesby's The Yankee and Cowboy War from 1976. In his book, The Ends of Power, former Nixon White House aide H.R. Bob Haldeman stated that the whole Bay of Pigs thing was a code word in the Nixon White House for the assassination of President Kennedy. And recall, those of you who are familiar with the Watergate scandal, that Nixon said that he did not want to release the Watergate tapes because he was afraid that, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote, might come out. In listening to Jack Ruby's testimony in front of Earl Warren, Gerald Ford, Arlen Specter, Leon Jaworski, later Watergate special prosecutor, and bearing in mind Richard Nixon's presence in Dallas, Texas on 11-22-63, and the fact that he lied about it to the FBI, I don't think it's difficult to figure out just exactly what it was that Richard Nixon was worried about. I would also note, as I indicated earlier, that as of late June of 1998, some 70,000 pages of notes concerning the Watergate tapes were destroyed after a successful court fight by the Nixon estate, the Watergate cover-up going on to this date, even as comparisons are being made between Bill Clinton's situation and Watergate. I would also note that at the beginning of the summer of 1998, the Zapruder film, the home movie of President Kennedy's assassination, was released on video cassette. As yet, however, the CD of Jack Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission has yet to be released. Until or unless it is, what you just heard, I'm afraid, is going to have to suffice.
That again from For the Record 108 from August of 1998. Now, the testimony of Jack Ruby before the Warren Commission was actually, what you heard was published by the late investigative reporter Dorothy Kilgallen. Dorothy Kilgallen was also a member of the famous late-night quiz show of many years ago called What's My Line? Dorothy Kilgallen also died under very suspicious circumstances after she claimed she was going to break the case, meaning the JFK assassination case, wide open. The following is from The Guns of November, Part 2, recorded on November 8th of 1963.
Number 9, Dorothy Kilgallen. Miss Kilgallen was the first to make the public existence of Aquilla Clemens, a witness to the Tippit killing whose name does not appear once in the Warren Report or volumes. She was also the only reporter ever to interview Jack Ruby privately since the killing of Oswald. During the Ruby trial, which she covered for the now-defunct New York Journal-American, Judge Joe B. Brown granted her 30 minutes alone with Ruby in the judge's chambers. The other reporters were furious. One of the biggest scoops of Miss Kilgallen's career came when she pirated the transcript of Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission and ran it in the Journal-American. Interrupting here, we're going to present you with part of that testimony next week, and I think you're going to find it most amazing. And when you hear that testimony, keep in mind that it's been public since 1964, that the first person to make this public was columnist and What's My Line panelist Dorothy Kilgallen. That was an old quiz show that was very popular many years ago. She was part of the panel on that. Okay, returning now to the account here of Miss Kilgallen and her death. One of the biggest scoops of Miss Kilgallen's career came when she pirated the transcript of Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission and ran it in the Journal American. Thousands of New Yorkers were shocked at the hopelessly inept questioning by Ruby of Ruby by Chief Justice Warren, by Warren's almost deliberate failure to follow up the leads Ruby was feeding him. Miss Kilgallen died in her bed on November 8, 1965. Dr. James Luke, L-U-K-E, a New York City medical examiner, said the cause of death was, quote, acute barbiturate and alcohol intoxication, circumstances undetermined, unquote. Dr. Luke said there were not high enough levels of either alcohol or barbiturates to have caused death, but that the two are additive, unquote, and together are quite enough to kill. This cause of death, he observed, is not at all uncommon. Was it suicide, accident, murder? Dr. Luke said there was no way of determining that. As we say, Dorothy Kilgallen probably does not belong on any list of Kennedy-related deaths. This is the editor's opinion. Many since then have come to very different conclusions. But questions do remain. An editor of Screen Stars magazine, Mary Branum, B-R-A-N-N-U-M, says she received a phone call a few hours before Dorothy's body was discovered, announcing that she had been murdered. Miss Kilgallen's What's My Line makeup man said that shortly before her death, she vowed she would, quote, crack this case, unquote. And another New York showbiz friend said Dorothy told him in the last days of her life, quote, in five more days, I'm going to bust this case wide open, unquote.
Again, one wonders about Dorothy Kilgallen, as we talked about in For the Record 190, and I'm not going to read about it because I'm not going to read anything concerning that. I will have a link to the New York Times obituary for John Charles Bailey, who was the host of What's My Line, on which Dorothy Kilgallen was a panelist. John Charles Bailey was Earl Warren's son-in-law. One wonders if perhaps he had, perhaps unwittingly or perhaps purposefully, who knows, disclosed information about Dorothy Kilgallen's, quote, about to break the case comment to Earl Warren, and if that perhaps led to Dorothy Kilgallen's death. Kilgallen's husband refused to say much about the death of his wife. Dorothy Kilgallen's widower refused to say much about her death. Ultimately, he, quote, committed suicide as well. A hint of what Jack Ruby may have wanted to talk with Earl Warren about is contained in the letter that Ruby was able to smuggle out of prison.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
This is from the book The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell. I interviewed Dick Russell in For the Record number 54. Ruby had the following to say, quote, don't believe the Warren report. That was only put out to make me look innocent. I'm going to die a horrible death anyway, so what would I have to gain by writing all this? So you must believe me that there is only one kind of people that would do such a thing, meaning the assassination. That would have to be the Nazis and that who is in power in this country right now. Japan is also in on the deal, but the old warlords are going to come back. I think he meant and. South America is also full of these Nazis. If those people were so determined to frame me, then you must be convinced that they have an ulterior motive for doing same. There is only one kind of people that would go to such extremes, and that would be the master race. So that is what Ruby had to say in a letter smuggled out of prison by Jack Ruby shortly before he died of cancer. Now, of course, as we looked at in The Guns of November, Part 3, and For the Record, Program 108 and 253, 961 and 962, the reason why Richard Nixon did not want to release the Watergate tapes was because of, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote, which in the Nixon White House was a code word for the assassination of JFK. E. Howard Hunt, Frank Sturgis, Bernard Barker, and among others, were veterans of the Bay of Pigs. Of course, there was a famous 18-and-a-half-minute erasure in the Watergate tapes. One of the things that we looked at in The Guns of November Part 3 and in For the Record 253 and in For the Record 961 was the fact that the formidable late CIA officer Gordon Novell had been tabbed by White House aide Charles Colson to study the feasibility of erasing the Watergate tapes using a degaussing gun. Although, on the record, both Novell and Colson denied having done that. In a technology publication from the summer of 1983, in response to what Gordon Novell felt was unfair criticism of him, he makes reference to, quote, his ultra-high technology role, quote, to erase the Watergate tapes. On October 28th of 1984, I was a guest on a late-night talk show on the now-defunct album-oriented rock station KOME in San Jose, hosted by Larry Johnson. Near the end of the show, about 20 minutes to 3 in the morning, I got a call from Gordon Novell, who took issue with some of my discussion of his role in Jim Garrison's investigation and also what he felt was unfair characterization of him as having erased the Watergate tapes. I made it clear to him that all of my information came from secondary sources, which he alleged were fraudulent. I also made it very clear to him that I was not gunning for him, and that I was not out to do him harm, and that I had a very healthy respect for the power he could wield and what he might be able to do to someone who actually was trying to hang him out to dry. Apparently satisfied by that, Gordon Novell then went on to discuss the Watergate case, and he had some very interesting things to say. And the following is from For the Record number 253. This is an excerpt of Gordon Novell's call. Again, that came at approximately 2:40 a.m. Actually, on the morning, I think, of October 29th of 1984.
I want to reiterate that I'm not, you know, gunning for you or pointing an accusing finger, that these are simply the facts. And also want to reiterate that I have a very healthy respect for your ability to deal with somebody that was, in fact, gunning for you, because I have done some research. Now, one of the things which, one of the connecting links between the investigation of the assassination of President Kennedy and the Watergate case, and here my information that I'm about to cite here comes from one of the books that I referred to earlier, a book called Coincidence or Conspiracy by a man named Bernard Fensterwald, one of the investigators in the Kennedy assassination. I personally think the guy is CIA, although there's...
I know that he's CIA.
Okay, well, there's a lot of good information in his book. Now, one of the things that he alleged in that book was that Charles Colson, one of the advisors of the Nixon White House and rumored by many, or reported by many, I should say, to be about the meanest SOB in a very mean crowd of SOBs in the Nixon White House, that he was recruiting you to, in essence, edit the very famous Watergate tapes using a degaussing gun, and that some speculation had arisen among people who have looked at some of the connections between Watergate and the JFK investigation, have suggested that possibly there may have been a connection between Colson's work, his alleged recruitment of you, and the very famous gaps that appeared in the Watergate tapes. Now, Colson has denied that you were in fact involved, but something which had come to my attention was I've forgotten the exact title, but it was a high technology publication. In fact, it might have been called something like High Technology Review or Technology Review, and it came out, I believe, in the early summer or late spring of 1983, and in that it referred to a meeting of electronic counterintelligence specials.
Myself, Alan Bell, and Mitch Werbel.
Yeah, right, and then in a letter in response to that, You talked about a number of things. You referred to some suits, and you referred to...
I am proceeding against the U.S. Treasury to trial right now. I've been granted... the court has granted me the right to try the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Frame-Ups for the sum of $651 million compensatory for faking tapes and the prosecution that they brought against me because of... my creation of the 1984 World's Fair.
Well, the thing that was interesting, there was a statement in that letter you wrote where you referred to your old, I think your exact words, correct me if I'm wrong now, were my ultra-high technology role in erasing the Watergate tapes. Now,
yeah.
was that a misstatement?
No, that was an exactly correct statement. What happened was Colson asked, he had done some back research. He had found out that Watergate had resulted from what we will call an enormous legal miscarriage of justice, which originated from me telling J. Edgar Hoover that I thought he was a raging fag in 1968 when he was harassing me because I sued Garrison and Playboy magazine and I exposed a counterintelligence operation that he had going at that time in the depositions, and he had sent me some very serious warnings about not doing these kind of things, and I told him that I was a free operative and that I did what the hell I pleased, and he made some other rather nasty remarks, so I kind of had a serious little disagreement with him in the Mayflower Hotel's Beef Baron room, and he then proceeded about 6 months later to charge me with interstate transportation of electronic intelligence equipment, to wit, a Crown CRC 6250F tape recorder and an AM/FM radio built in a briefcase that I purchased in Lazarus Department Store in Columbus, Ohio, and took to Reno, Nevada. That, in turn, right prior to that, the professor who headed up the House Assassination Committee after Sprague was removed had penned the laws that created Watergate, i.e., thou shalt not possess a device that is, quote, primarily useful for the surreptitious interception of wire or oral communication, unquote, which became Title III. And I was the first man convicted for possessing such a device. I carry them all the time now. You can buy them anywhere, but the law is still on the books, and the government, i.e., the Justice Department, doesn't enforce those laws because they're patently fraudulent and unconstitutional. But they did enforce them, A, on me, and then about a year and a half, 2 years later, they enforced them on Mr. Liddy and Mr. Hunt et al.
Mm-hmm.
Possessing Liddy paid Jim McCord $35,000 for a bogus transmitter, which was placed in the Watergate in the first entry and then apparently malfunctioned, I believe, on cue and forced him to go back because I believe that McCord set the whole thing up and that Liddy and the rest of them were a bunch of dupes. But the point I'm trying to make to you is that history in these things is generally rife with there's some wheat there, but it's ground up into the chaff. And if you don't carefully and microscopically sit down and pick the facts apart, you really don't, all you get is the writer's versions. How can a man go from being the chief of security of the Kennedy investigation, and who actually in great measure promulgated the thing with Garrison, and then find out that Garrison's completely... horse feathers or bull feathers, and then turn around and the next day when we disagree about he shouldn't fake a letter with and superimpose Lee Harvey Oswald's signature onto Clay Shaw's stationery in order to create non-existent evidence, and we had a very steaming fight about faking evidence, he then charged me with being a material witness because that's the only thing he could charge me till he fabricated another charge.
Gordon, okay. We only have about 5 more minutes here before we have to leave the air.
There's one more thing I just wanted to say very quickly. Yes, we're going to have to move along here, Mr. Novell. There is just one quick... So, in other words, you deny actually having erased the Watergate tapes.
Only because they didn't pay me.
Okay, well, but in other words, are you saying that...
I did propose to erase all 4,004 tapes. I did the counterintelligence investigation for Fred Bizard and Sinclair and those guys that said that the tape gap was an accident. Alan Bell was the one who wrote the report, the fellow who invented the voice lie detector for me.
Mm-hmm.
And but at the same time, yes, I did propose to erase all the tapes, and it was quite a legal issue. Jaworski said before he died, told me one afternoon, he says it was completely legal, because until the Supreme Court ruled those tapes were evidence, we could have erased them.
Okay, so in other words, here's the point that I wanted to make, is that when I saw that letter that you wrote in that technology publication, I took it from the phraseology as a tacit admission that, in fact, you had been involved in that role. And I'm a little bit confused as to what you're saying is basically between the lines.
There were six reports that said the tape, that the 18 and a half minute tape gap had been done on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
There was a report that never made it in the press because the press didn't want to say anything about it, that destroyed the indictment, that Jaworski and I can't remember the other prosecutor's name had prepared for Rosemary Woods. I had done the rebuttal study and prepared the rebuttal study with Dector Counterintelligence and Security in Virginia that said that there was an accident. And we had effectively gotten in their knickers because there was a possibility that that tape had been accidentally erased. I did not erase that tape. I would have erased every tape in Watergate, and I can assure you President Nixon wishes I had.
All righty. Well, listen, a couple of things very quickly because we're virtually out of time here. I just want to say that I'm totally convinced that this is, in fact, Gordon Novell. I wanted to thank you very much for participating and for your remarkable degree of candor on certain subjects here. And I just wanted to say that this has been some fantastic radio. Perhaps some of the listeners are wondering, well, gee whiz, hey, we didn't get a chance to call in. This has really been quite amazing that, as I say, this is a fellow who has been alleged by many to have been involved in the assassination. He certainly has denied it and presented a lot of information in backing up his claims. And anyway, it can be said that Gordon Novell is one of the leading figures that has cropped up in connection with the case, not ascribing any guilt to him, and that really those of you in the audience are really quite privileged here to have this kind of a discussion. I want to say, Mr. Novell, also, I consider this personally... As I say, you know, I was 14 when the assassination happened. This is really one of the highlights of my life. It's an amazing thing. certainly anybody that goes public talking about the kind of thing, and I'm on three non-commercial stations up here in the Bay Area, and I'm a, quote, conspiracy theorist, unquote. Certainly the intelligence community keeps an eye on you. You know, I just hope, in fact, that...
Eye on me.
Excuse me?
They keep a very close eye on me.
Oh yeah, I was just hoping, in fact, that your participation in the broadcast was due just to the fact that you heard this on the radio and stuff. As I say, I'm not gunning for you.
80 miles an hour down the freeway and enjoying the ride when I heard you mention my name unfairly. What I thought was unfairly in the sense that it needed a response because it was not put in juxtaposition with the facts of what actually occurred.
Okay, well, again, I've cited the sources for my information. I understand
the sources, but the sources are erroneous, too.
Okay, well, again, I just want to reiterate that I'm not gunning for you, and as I say, I'm familiar with your situation and have a very healthy respect for your abilities. I just wanted to make that absolutely clear.
Well, I have taken to trouble used to follow me around like a little black cloud, but these days it follows me around like a little green cloud. I took all my talents and applied them to a fellow by the name of DeLorean and managed to do the strategic planning and investigation for that case in the main, and I like the outcome of it. It showed what can be done when somebody really turns the rocks over, and when they don't find a scorpion, they dig under the dirt and find the scorpion.
Okay, Mr. Novell, we're going to have to leave the air, but if you would hold on for just a second, and we'd like to just thank you again for your most informative phone call.
I just wanted to reiterate
informative.
For the audience that perhaps some of you are chafing in the bit because you haven't had a chance to call up, but this has really been this is amazing radio. It's very seldom that you get any situation where you get someone whose name has actually been involved with the case and get a chance to just sort of air some of this stuff out. I'm really nonplussed and quite thrilled, and this is really quite an experience, and I just hope all the people out in the audience hope the people have taped it, and I hope they put this one in their mental hopper. This is quite an experience, and Mr. Novell, I wanted to thank you for your time and efforts.
Okay, thanks for your call.
All right.
Would you hold on for just a moment? Thank you.
That again, from a guest appearance that I made on the Expressway Talk Show in the wee wee hours of Monday morning of October 29th of 1984. The host was Larry Johnson. KOME is no longer in existence. There is a radio station with those call letters, but it's a different frequency and a different format. And it went down the stream of time, so to speak. So you heard Gordon Novell speaking on his own behalf there. I thought his comments were very interesting. And he was quite forthcoming and it would, as to exactly what may have happened to the Watergate tapes. Was he, in fact, involved with that? He sort of hinted that he might have been, but that he couldn't admit it because they paid him. When I pressed him, he said, nope. Mm-mm. So there you have it, something of a small footnote to the Watergate case and perhaps the assassination of President Kennedy as well. Who knows?
Now, again, from For the Record, 253. Note Gordon Novell's enigmatic comment when I asked him, so you deny actually having erased the Watergate tapes? And he said, quote, only because they didn't pay me, unquote. He then went on to say that he actually was a member of the electronics, the panel of electronics specialists that testified that the famous 18-and-a-half-minute gap in one of the Watergate tapes was could have been an accident. Rosemary Woods, Nixon's personal secretary, hired Warren Commission counsel Charles Rhine, R-H-Y-N-E, to be her defense attorney in that case. Novell then went on to maintain that he also was a member of the panel of electronics experts who testified that the famous Dictabelt recording from a Dallas motorcade motorcycle that indicated there was a fourth shot in Dealey Plaza was in fact authentic, thereby confirming it was pretty obvious that there had been more than one shooter. So that was, again, from For the Record 253. Novell, in that call, asked how he could have gone from being the chief of security for Jim Garrison's investigation to a suspect. A key to that is provided in the book The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, The CIA and the Rise of America's Secret Government by David Talbot, who writes on page 597, even the private investigator Garrison, hired to sweep his office for electronic bugs, turned out to be a CIA operative. After Dulles was subpoenaed by Garrison, the security specialist, Gordon Novell, phoned the spymaster to slip him inside information about the DA's strategy. That again from The Devil's Chessboard by David Talbot. Gordon Novell being Alan Dulles' man, or perhaps one of them, inside of Garrison's investigation. All of which makes the powerful and deadly Gordon Novell's comment all the more significant. Recall that in the interview that you just heard, Gordon Novell had the following to say.
So, in other words, you deny actually having erased the Watergate tapes.
Only because they didn't pay me.
Okay, well,
I guess that is as close as we will ever come to finding out what actually produced the gaps in some of the Watergate tapes. This concludes For the Record program number 963, Watergate and the Assassination of President Kennedy, part 3. This is being recorded on June 20th, 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.